Sidebar with stand-up comic Chrissy Mayer.
All right, people. No point in even hiding it. I was late. And for those of you who get notifications, you might know why. I was not late because I was sending out the sneak peek of today's vlog. I was late because I had a screen open somewhere that I could not find. And I was hearing myself in an echo that I could not find. And I had to shut all the screens because I'm an idiot and I don't know how to work computers yet at the ripe old age of, how old am I? 42. So that is why I'm late. Who can I blame? I'll blame the kids. It's always easy to blame the kids. Hold on one second. No. Where's the haircut commie? Yeah, no. Freedom fro, baby. I'm growing it out. I'm not going to cut my hair for a while. I think I like it. The only problem is like you get old and then you have a lot of gray hair in your afro and then it doesn't look quite as cool as it did when you were, you know, a ripped 16-year-old with streaks through your hair because you were living free and living wild. This is going to be fun, people. This is the second time I will meet Chrissy Mayer, stand-up comic, for those of you who do not know, actress, comedian, or as we say in French, comédienne, double N-er. So this is going to be fun. I did a live on her channel, and now we're going to do a live on this channel and get into some fun stuff. What do I say here? Standard disclaimers. I did not put slow mode on. I am relying on everyone's good behavior to not cause me to have to put the slow mode on, because I think we can get away with it for this stream. And I like to, you know, encourage the chat. What was I about to say? Super chats. Great one. Secret hair dye. No. I can't. I'm not dyeing my hair. And the other thing is like, what am I going to dye my beard, dye my hair? Then it's going to be like, you know, collagen implants and whatever. The only thing I want to maybe get rid of is this grimace wrinkle. I call that the wrinkle of anger of the world in which we live. Hippoopy, thank you for the super chat. And so that brings us into the standard disclaimers. I do my best to get to the super... I've screwed up everything. Now I'm uncomfortable. I do my best to get to the super chats. If I don't get to them and you're going to be miffed, don't give it. It's not a right of entry into the conversation. My God, let's go, Brandon. It's never going to get old. If you're going to be miffed, if I don't get to your super chat, don't give it. No legal advice, no medical advice, no undermining the electoral fortification. Although if you haven't watched my vlog from yesterday, breaking down the deposition of Eric Coomer, go ahead and watch it. And Nick's chat got him a strike, LOL. I do not believe. I have all of the YouTube things in effect so that, you know, chat doesn't penalize me. Holding potentially inappropriate comments. Although I don't know what the buzzwords that you're not allowed, you know, whatever. How do we get out of Canada? No comment. We are simultaneously streaming on Rumble. YouTube takes 30% of the super chats. Rumble takes 20. So if you want to support a company you like, better for the creator, Rumble rants on Rumble. Okay, with that said, let us get the show on the road. Did Viva say he got his breast? Okay, with that said, people, Chrissy Mayer, for those of you who don't know, look, Robert Barnes has introduced me to a whole new realm of pop culture that I would have never otherwise known about, including Doomcock, who we need to do another stream with one of these days, Razor Fist, Geeks and Gamers, and Chrissy Mayer. I think we met Chrissy on the YouTubes, and fun stuff, and I've got questions tonight that we didn't get into in my stream on her channel, so let's get into it. Chrissy, I'm going to bring you in. 3, 2, 1.
I'm here. Oh, wow.
How goes the battle?
This is great. I very much love your French pronunciation of comédienne. It sounds like so exotic and fancy. Hello, come here with your croissants.
The funniest thing, and like I'm waiting for, I don't know who's going to do the stand-up bit on this, but in the era of, you know, gender politics and all these things, in French, words are either masculine or feminine. So you have acteur, actrice, comédien, comédienne. And my goodness, I mean, with the way the world is changing and words are changing, I mean, it's only, I do wonder if it's a matter of time before language, gender issues become an actual, you know, political.
Yeah. Will we have a non-binary words? Will we have transgendered? Yeah.
I don't know if you saw it, Chrissy. I did the breakdown of that decision coming out of British Columbia, where a company was, you know, effectively fined for misgendering an employee, and they determined that the termination of employment to be motivated by gender discrimination or gender identity. But the judgment employed the term they the entire time in reference to the plaintiff. But people rightly pointed out, you know, they is a plural. And so when the judge is speaking of they in the plural while referring to a singular plaintiff, I mean, it makes reading very, very difficult. Okay.
It's almost like it was invented by a group of people who want to confuse you or to control, not because it makes sense.
It does get confusing, and I will slow down. I was a little frazzled for being late, and I apologize. Chrissy, before we get into it, Robert should be here, but I'll bring him in when he gets here. For anybody who doesn't know you, the elevator pitch before we get into the good goods of tonight's discussion.
Yes, I go up and down. No. Yes, I'm a comedian, right? Like an elevator. I'm a comedian, podcaster. I've been doing stand-up now like 10, 11 years. I have a show on Anthony Cumia's network called The Wet Spot. It's like a sex dating relationship show. I wanted to model it after original Howard Stern back when he was fun. And then I do an interview, a longer form interview podcast called the Chrissy Mayer Podcast, which is on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud 4 days a week. And then I do uncensored episodes on Rockfin where we talk about all the no-no subjects we can't touch on YouTube, as I'm sure you know.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Now, you said the show was called The Wet Spot or
The Wet White Spot. Wet. Can you imagine if I called it The White Spot? Yes, my new show about white supremacy, The White Spot.
Well, yeah. But I ask what the title? I'm going to have to be ignorant and I'm going to have to ask. I'm not sure. What does the title mean?
Well,
is it a reference to genitalia?
Wet spot, it's usually what remains after a good time is had, generally in the bedroom. I don't want to be graphic, but yeah, it's just okay. Like you get excited. I don't know. Maybe you pee a little. Maybe it's something else. I don't know. I've actually never had to explain what a wet spot is. So thank you for giving me that opportunity. Okay, yeah, we'll have comedians on, porn stars on, you know, people of note. We had the Bagel Boss on a couple years ago. That was a high mark.
Bagel Boss, for anybody who does not remember, Bagel Boss was on. He was on Howard Stern at one point as well, right? But he had a... You know, this will be an intro before we get into the actual intro. Tell the world who the Bagel Boss is if they don't know what he did.
Well, he's kind of a Long Island icon, and I am also a Long Islander, so I felt for this little guy. He basically had a meltdown at the Bagel. I don't know if it was called the Bagel Boss. It was called the Bagel Boss? Okay. The store was actually called the Bagel Boss out in Long Island. The guy, I believe, is like... He's definitely under 5 feet for sure. Like, I think he's either illegal or maybe he's an illegal midget. But he freaked out. It's like, you know, when you meet a chihuahua and it barks so loud and it doesn't know how small it is. This is the human equivalent of that. And he just sort of like puffed out his chest. He acted very tough in this bagel store. He had a meltdown because he's somebody who, like, you know, obviously small man complex. What is it called? The small man disease, the Napoleon complex. There's somebody who, like, they go through life and everything is an affront to their size. And he's just, you know, built up, ready to fight at all times. You know, there's people who aren't short who have that nature, but you know, the lady behind the counter says the wrong thing. And he was like, what? And he just freaked out. And he like decked some guy twice his size. And then the guy decked him and he was on the floor and it was like a viral video. And this guy parlayed that into, he thought he was going to have this big career and be so famous. And all the while he treated like everybody around him like crap. And he did my show. My show was one of the first ones he did. And then he left me like very threatening voicemails. I think he's a little bipolar or something.
Okay.
I still have them saved in my phone. I could play them for you.
No. We don't need to do that. Now, with that said, I see Robert is in the house. So I'm going to bring Robert in, see if the order works out well. This is perfect.
Yes, I'm in the middle.
Robert, how are you doing?
Mostly good, good. I was on I made the mistake of accepting a invite to a sports bettors Las Vegas radio show to discuss the John Gruden legal implications of the John Rugen case, John Gruden case. And he failed to mention to me, unfortunately, he apologized afterwards, but failed to mention to me that he had a co-host and that his co-host was this sort of raging lefty commie nutcase. And instead of discussing the legal issues of the John Gruden case, for which whatever John Gruden said is actually irrelevant, most likely under the law, he just started attacking me, saying, why was I defending John Gruden? What are my views? What do I agree with these statements? On and on. I was like, I'm not here to discuss that. So then he transitioned into defaming Kyle Rittenhouse just in the middle of it. And I was like, okay. I was like, one, you're going to get sued. I'll show you what cancel culture looks like up close and personal. And two, I'm out of here. So first interview I've ever cut off live right in the middle of it. But whoa, put me in an agitated mood all day. But I think I'll satiate that agitation by suing him when the Kyle Rittenhouse case is over. Because somebody Robert, who now- can't understand. Folks, this is an okay sign. That's an okay sign. If you're still calling that a white power sign, you can get sued. I've already won on that issue in court. So quit calling it that. Quit lying about Kyle Rittenhouse. Quit lying about some of these people. And if you're going to invite a lawyer on and ambush him and then libel his client, make sure you know who the lawyer is first.
Yeah, don't fuck with Barnes.
Booyah, Barnes. Now, but hold on. Now, first of all, who was the left-wing, I'm going to paraphrase, left-wing commie individual? And what show is this? And where can we see this? Unless you don't want us to see it.
It was on the radio. It's a Las Vegas talk radio show that talks sports. So I didn't know any of this. The guy who invited me later apologized, but you know, should have apprised me. I wouldn't. Generally, I get so many invites, I generally don't appear on most shows. And one of the reasons is I don't like these circumstances. If I don't know who the person is, don't know this was a favor. You always get burned for your kindnesses. You know, that's the nature of the animal. But you know, other than that, good.
All right, the road to hell is paved in good intentions. Chrissy.
Yeah.
Wow.
We've got, if you've seen one sidebar, you know where this goes. We need to get to the person before we get to the subject matter. I have learned not to ask people how old they are, but if you could contextualize us, are you a Gen X, a Gen Z? What's after Gen Z?
And what in between is millennial.
Thank you so much. I'm definitely a millennial. I don't know if I identify as one, like emotionally and mentally, but yeah, I'm a firm millennial. I guess I don't care about my age. I'm going to be 38 next month, but I don't look it.
You do not look it. You actually look substantially younger. Where are you from? Siblings? What'd your parents do? And how did you end up in stand-up comedy? Because I've got questions on the practice of comedy itself. But childhood, in order for people to understand how you got to where you are.
Born and raised on Long Island, which is why I had a little bit of empathy for the bagel boss. But yeah, youngest of three kids. My brother and sister both went into like regular jobs. Like my sister is now a teacher. My brother is a civil engineer. And growing up, like when I was very young, my mother didn't work. Like she didn't get a job till I was in first grade. And my dad was a landscaper. He was among the last of the great white landscapers of our time before the job was, you know, now mostly you stereotype landscapers as part of the Latinx community. But no, he was, I was, you know, had this joke with him and he'd be like, money doesn't grow on trees. I'd be like, but you're literally a landscaper. I'm like, that's what you do. But it was great. It was like, you know, we were like middle class. It was pretty cool about the road I grew up on. Like my mother's father built the house that we, you know, that we lived in. It was like the first house on the street there at Reeve Road, but it was like on the smaller side. So of course, like growing up, I was like ashamed of like how much money my parents made or the house, whatever. So I would have people drop me off at like the neighbor's house or like two houses down because the rest of the houses were like split level. They looked a little bit bigger. I remember for years I campaigned to my dad to like, please attach the garage to the house so that the house would look bigger. But, you know, like never stole from them or anything like that. I feel like I was like a pretty good kid. I had like one party when they were out of town and I almost got away completely scot-free. Like I was up till 3 a.m. picking like butts out of the grass. And then my mom comes home and there's just like a backpack full of beer sitting in the middle of the basement. And I was like, great. But how I got into comedy, I guess I was always a funny kid. Like I remember I'd be sitting in church like and they would pass out the little like prayer sheets, like the prayer papers, and I would do little drawings on them and like pass them up. And like, luckily my grandma would be there to intercept the drawings. Cause one time I drew like the, not the priest, cause it was, I was raised Methodist, but, the preacher, the, I'm forgetting the like exact word for it.
Don't ask me.
Pastor, the pastor, I guess I drew a picture of her jumping off the roof of the church. So that was quickly intercepted by grandma. And so I was, I don't know, like my family always like, oh, you're the bad one. You're always acting out. And then as I grew up, that kind of turned into, I guess, a comedy career. I was really attracted to stand up because I felt like I could express myself in front of a room full of people and there would be no backlash. I didn't have to worry about feelings or who would be mad at me. I also felt like I could be totally honest. Whereas I didn't feel like I could express myself in front of my family. Like if I complained about anything, they'd be like, ah, you're making a big deal out of it. And I don't know if that had to do with money or just how boomers generally raise their kids or the fact that my dad is like a German immigrant and his dad would kind of like, you know, beat up on him. He didn't really have like the greatest relationship with his parents. And like my father's dad was in the Mooney cult. And so like he was, you know, just hate, you know, my dad was just raised to hate all types of religion, but it's pretty wild. I haven't met anybody else who's like, whose grandfather was in a cult basically. So yeah, I remember in college, like I didn't really know what I wanted to do. My mom
actually two things actually, before we get into there, Latinx spoken, I don't know what that means in the end. What is Latinx?
Oh, I'm saying that sarcastically. Like I absolutely don't seriously call people Latinx. Like
what does the X mean for anybody who doesn't know, like myself, the X on the Latin, Latino, we understand, but what is Robert, do you know what Latinx is?
It's just a politically correct term they came up with. I presume in part to, I guess, get around gender issues. So someone might be neither Latino nor Latina. They're just, let's call everybody Latinx. You know, it's like he and they, instead of he or she, the University of Tennessee and some other places were saying you should say Z. You know, I mean, it's all a bad parody. It's all a comedy gone AWOL. It's somebody who saw this, you know, an old script from Orwell or Huxley and thought this would be nice to implement in real life as a historical text. Now, you mentioned your father was on that German immigrant side. What about your mom's ancestry?
My mom's side is like, well, my grandmother was born in this country, but like her side is like Norwegian. And I think my grandfather's side on my mother's side was like more English. So I think my grandma, like she ended up going back to Norway at some point, but definitely like closer relatives, you know, on the Germany side.
Chrissy, we're not, there's two things now. Hentai, never going to be seen the same again. Fauci juice and the wet spot will be ongoing memes. What did you study in university?
Oh, God. Okay. So I had no idea. And I had like poor guidance overall. It was my mother being like, you know, Chrissy, you could one day work at a hotel. Like that was her big dream for me, to work at a hotel in New York City. She's like, you know, study up, you know, you could be anybody's assistant you want. And so that's kind of what I did. I was a communications major, like media studies, you know, specification, I guess. And I sort of like dabbled with the student TV station and still really didn't know, like graduated. My first job out of college was I worked at Radio City Music Hall as a tour guide. And It was like the first time I had sushi. It was like my first job in the city. Like this is how clueless about sushi I was. Like I ate the plastic green grass separator and I was like, oh, this is different. Like I've never had this type of food before. But yeah, I had to memorize like this thick of a binder of like facts about Radio City. And they were like, you guys are going to love it. Wesley Snipes used to work here. And all of us are just like cleaning up garbage. And like, it was like really unglamorous, but I've had probably like 15 day jobs, I think, since I've been out of college, just because that's kind of the deal. Like, unless you have rich parents, like you really have to, or a rich spouse or something, like you, most comics, like they have some kind of a day job until they can make enough money doing other stuff.
Now, was it like public schools or private schools growing up?
Public schools. Oh, yes. Very public. We're talking cheese bagels, fights outside the deli, you know, 25-cent candies kind of a thing. Yeah. And it was cool because my mom worked. And then when she ended up getting a job, I was in first grade when she went to work, and she was like so torn up about having to go to work. I'm like, Mom, it's fine, whatever. I was a very cool first grader. And then, so her job was in the middle school, and she worked for like the Department of Music and Performing Arts. So I would go, like, once I got to middle school, I could like visit her in her office and get money for the snack machine or whatever. But then I kind of did get into, like, all three of us kids played instruments, and I even did like a little bit of like theater in high school. So I think it helped us be like a little musical.
So you're the character they came up with, you know, this one time at band camp story.
No, yeah. Yeah. I didn't put any instruments, you know, in my nether regions, but
I do. Yeah. You know, Chrissy, I wonder what, how many people watching this are so young that they've actually never seen American Pie like that.
It's tragic.
I watched it recently. It was not as funny watching it again as I thought it was watching it the first time. But okay, so here's a question I have. You're working at Radio City Music Hall as a pure, I'd say minimum wage job, not in a derogatory way, just like you're not there as a performer. Does working there get you into the door in terms of a performance? Does it make you want to do it more? Does it make you want to do it less?
Oof, no. Because I learned right away that I was never going to be a Rockette. Do you know you have to be between 5'6 and 5'10 and a half to be a Rockette? And the way they create the illusion that they're all the same height is that they put the tallest girls in the middle and then do-do-do-do-do. Or it's the shortest girls in the middle and then they go out. Whatever. It's one way or the other. And that I learned that elephants were hesitant to go into the elevators because they could feel like the ground under them was like a false ground. Elephants are very smart. So they had like push them down the stairs. It was probably, they probably did a lot of unethical shit. But yeah, very minimum wage, very much like a 3-piece polyester suit. I had to wear like a bow tie, just endless grandparents showing me pictures of their sons and asking if I was single. I had braces also, by the way, adult braces, and a short like Midwestern Karen mom haircut, blonde, swooped. Yeah, I was going through a lot.
Now, how early did you know you wanted to do comedy?
Oh boy. A little bit when I was in college, I did a little bit on the improv team, and then I was like, I enjoyed it, but then I kind of got blowback because I wasn't a theater major, and it was kind of, as everyone knows, like theater kids are very cultish, and as are the people who like run the departments. So I kind of got like elbowed out of that. But it was not until I thought I wanted to be, and then, you know, before I graduated, I was like, okay, I really want to be a reporter. Okay, I'm going to go into news. This is what I'm going to do. And I interned at Dateline when I was a junior in college. And then I got a load of Stone Phillips. I was like, oh, I cannot, this is horrible. This would be a slow, slow death. So I was able to reach out to the only female writer at Conan on the time. This is while Conan was still in New York. I don't know how I did it. That was pretty cool of me to do that, to think to reach out. And then I was able to get myself an internship at Late Night with Conan O'Brien for my senior year. And I just got so lucky because there's so much competition for these internships, but more so during the summer, because that's when the sons and daughters of everybody who works at NBC get handed these internships. And I was just so lucky that I was from Long Island, went to school in Connecticut. I was able to commute, come in twice a week, get college credit for it. So I was really lucky with that. And it was being around those comedy people, the writers. I mean, among the interns, it was so competitive. It was like, we were like knocking each other over for like, who can get Conan's coffee? Like who can take the dinner order? And it was like, you know, we're getting paid nothing. Now you can't even do a free internship, but the competition was fierce. And it was pretty neat because in my intern class was Ellie Kemper, who went on to The Office. And I remember because she ended up marrying Michael Coman, who was a writer at the time. Like, I remember those two started dating and I was like, how old is she? So that was exciting. A couple other stand-up comics were in my same intern class. So I would talk to the writers and they would just say to me like, well, if you're interested in comedy, like you should really go into improv. So when I graduated college, I enrolled with the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, was able to just take improv classes while living at home. Like all of my extra money went into, you know, I'd be working my day job and then I would go do like a 3-hour improv class, you know, like every week. And I did that for years.
I got to ask if this is going to show my own internal biases or bias. Whenever I think of, first of all, I know what went on at law firms in terms of internships and culture and, you know, lifestyle. So having seen that, when I know what I think of Hollywood and entertainment, I just picture this as being you get up in the ladder by either being a huge kiss butt, having family connections, or I picture everyone just barters in sex or sexual favors in this industry. And having heard Horatio Sands' story, all these stories coming out of it, I have heard nothing that's going to contradict my presuppositions. Is that what the environment is actually like when you're an intern, when you're working in the industry, and how much of it actually comes into play on a daily basis?
At NBC, I mean, there was like really none of that at all. Like I think they were probably aware that that's a thing. And I like looked up to the writers, kind of, they were like uncles to me. So there was like none of that at all. Definitely there was some of that, like once I started doing UCB classes, like, and who knows, I don't know. I only know my own experience, but I would notice the girls that were at my level or like not as funny, the one that was like dating, you know, the improv 101 guy, or at least dating this coach, dating this teacher, they're sort of moving up in the ranks. They're getting on like the house team. And I was like, oh, I was like, there's nobody here I really like. Like, oh, do I have to, you know, like, do I have to get fingered in a basement just to like get through this? So I just didn't. I just was like, eh, not about that. I just figured like, oh, well, talent will be the thing that comes through in the end. And so I ended up doing all the classes at UCB, you know, a small team. And then I did all the classes at the Magnet Theater, which was a similar improv theater in the city.
What is UCB?
The Upright Citizens Brigade. It was started by E.B. Right. Poehler and Matt Besser and this other guy named Matt. And it was that, talk about cults. Woo. I was very much part of the improv cult for years. A lot of the shows were very good, and you idolize these people. You spend as many days as you can just in that dank little basement, like watching as many shows as you can, because it's kind of like extra credit. You know, your teachers kind of take note, and you're just like a sponge. You're just trying to be like the best improviser you can. And in these improv communities are a lot of theater kids, a lot of musical theater kids. And then you also have like Bill, who's coming out of a divorce and wants to meet new people. Or you have like Randy, who's an accountant who wants to work on his public speaking. So it's an interesting like mix of folks.
Right. A lot of the people that are engaged in improv are not comedians that do it. I mean, it is considered a great way for extemporaneous speaking, public interaction, different, you know, learning those kinds of engagement. It's a way people reengage, but it always struck me as the hardest form of comedy there is.
It's hard. Yeah. And it's, at the end of the day, you're only as funny as your least funny team member. So you could be great, but you know, if you have someone who keeps torpedoing the scenes or isn't a good listener, and ultimately like you, that's why I moved on to stand up, because you have to pay for a coach. You have to pay for a room. You know, 5 to 8 of you need to meet up at the same place, you know, once a week, a couple times a week to practice. So I was like, oh, stand up is like, it's scarier, but it's far more autonomous and you can do more. You can get more sets in a night.
Chris, I'm going to bring up this question because it's an interesting question. I'm not sure I agree with the premises, but I'm trying to think now of examples that would disprove the premises. Chrissy, mate, what is it about female comedians making everything about sex? And now that I think, I'm thinking out loud, I can think of Lisa Lampanelli, the one who had the HBO special, I forget her name, Schumer's daughter, Amy Schumer. I can think of a lot of male comedians that it's all about sex as well. I don't know if there's more male comedians than female, so that you notice the disparity more or you notice the diversity more, but do you agree with the premises and how do you answer the question?
Yes and no. And I feel like ultimately it comes down to biology, and a big theme of stand-up is to talk about what you know. And I've heard this for years, like, oh, I'm not into female comics because they just talk about their vagina. They just talk about sex. They just talk about their boyfriend. And like, women are, if you're going to get into stand-up at all, it's because you are more sensitive. It's because you do, you have a knack for observing yourself and the people around you, humanity, your own relationships. And women in general are better at like knowing themselves and observing relationships, like, you know, figuring you out. Like some women are like little spies, you know, good and bad, right? Like your strengths are also sort of like your weaknesses. Like, yeah, comics are sensitive, but it's like, it's our observational skills on the good side of the coin. And on the bad side of the coin is like, yeah, maybe we can't handle a heckler, or we, you know, just like are too sensitive, like whatever. I don't know if I'm explaining it well, but I think like for women, yeah, like we just notice how we are in relationships. And that's the thing is, like, a lot of my stand-up fans are women, but most of my podcast fans and listeners are men. And it blew me away when I saw my analytics on just how many men, like 90% of my YouTube listeners are men. And just, I don't know what it is. It's maybe it's the visual nature of the, of YouTube, but so that's been pretty fascinating. But usually when I do like stand-up shows, like now I feel like I've leveled off and just as many men and women enjoy my stuff. But like now, I would get booked to do like bachelorette parties, bridal showers. So those are fun.
Now, what were some of the big cultural influences growing up in the sense of whether it's TV, whether it's film, you know, not just limited to comedians? What were some of the shapers of your cultural experience?
Absolutely. It would be like me and my dad would watch Married with Children every single episode, and
that show could not be made today.
Oh, it couldn't. It was so good, and it very much mirrored my own like parents' relationship, and that was my framework of growing up. Like, oh, like marriage is not a pleasant thing. The people involved don't respect each other. They don't even like each other. Like, you're just both kind of acting out of obligation 24/7. Everyone's sarcastic. Everyone's putting each other down, and like, I guess that kind of helped to shape my sense of humor a little bit. We would just shit on each other behind each other's back because nobody in my family had great communication skills. Like, we wouldn't be direct. It was always, talking to my dad about my mom, talking to my dad, because, you know, that was the model that our parents kind of had for us. But yeah, Married with Children, always The Simpsons. The Simpsons was so great. I was just watching like a Halloween special the other day, and I was like mouthing every single word. And I was like, I haven't seen this in years, but yet it's forever burned into my brain. Also Mad TV. I watched a lot of that. A little bit of Seinfeld, but like my sister was the one that was into Seinfeld growing up. So I just was like, I didn't really get it. And as an adult, I think I appreciate it more now. And then when I was in college, before I even was interested in comedy, I would go to the library, like at Fairfield U, and just like listen to old George Carlin. I don't know how that came about, but I was like, he was probably the first stand-up comic where I was like, oh, wow, it doesn't sound like jokes. He's just like speaking truth.
It's funny. George Carlin, I think, is he's amazing. And because it was not just slapstick comedy. It was observational. It was philosophy disguised as humor, in the same way Dave Chappelle, I think, is philosophy disguised as humor, but we'll get there. Hold on, let me just get this off here.
Yeah, In Living Color too. Also, like Family Matters, 227, 21 Jump Street, like
Golden Girls was a good
Golden
one.
Golden Girls, yeah.
Growing up, we used to have it was Golden Girls. We used to watch Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune, but we used to watch Benny Hill. I mean, if anybody has ever seen Benny Hill, that is something that can never be made today. And the fact that things could not be made today, again, is a big problem. It's not something we should be celebrating. We'll swing back from this pendulum. But so you biggest influences in terms of stand-up comedy, George Carlin and...
Carlin, I love. I was lucky enough to open for these two guys who are, like, I think people I really admire and look up to, is Doug Stanhope and Adam Carolla, both guys that I've opened for this year. And I just think they're the two of the best, like, working right now. Of course, like every comic says Patrice O'Neill. Everyone, of course, says like Chappelle and Chris Rock. And like, those are all like, of course, like, you're not going to deny that they're great. But just for me right now, like Ricky Gervais, Adam Carolla, and Doug Stanhope, in terms of like more free speech oriented, just like not giving a fuck, unapologetic, like, it speaks to me a lot right now.
Now, how much, like, I was fascinated by Chappelle's last show, not so much for the political controversy, but how it was almost architected like a closing argument would be in a courtroom, which just had comedic interjections.
Yes.
And, you know, I've only watched him sporadically over the years, so I don't know if he's always done that or that was for this show. How much is your, how do you structure your show?
Yeah, it was interesting watching Chappelle because it's, people give him shit for like, oh, well, he addressed X, Y, and Z. And it's like, you kind of have to. He's not going to be sitting on Twitter all day, like, responding to everybody. I'm sure, like, over the months, he's like, all right, well, I have these questions that keep coming up, or I keep getting shit for the same things. I have to respond to them. And he had the floor. But for me, it's like the best stand-up sets are always a combination of my material and crowd work. And like I think of my crowd work as like a big word bank. It's all up here. It's 10 years worth of stuff. Like I can always reach up and grab something, but try to chunk things out by theme. And a perfect show feels like you're like weaving a quilt between like getting information from what you know and then like bringing it into the crowd, or going into the crowd and be like, oh, perfect. You guys are on a first date. I have a joke about that. And you throw it back in. And the degree to which I can kind of seamlessly go back and forth, it makes it really fun for me and like very fresh for the audience. And some comics don't play with the crowd at all. And I just don't know how you can do that, because it's like you're paying for a live experience. There's so many things competing for your time. Like it's just mostly easier to just stay home and watch Netflix. But the fact that people are like up and out dressed at a show, it's like you might as well. I feel like you owe it to them to make them part of the show.
No, it's a question that I've always had. Like you're in a live show. First of all, do you find it easier to perform to bigger crowds or to smaller crowds?
Ooh, okay. Well, it's interesting because they both have their pros and cons. Like a bigger crowd is a little bit more intimidating. Like if you're doing like a big theater show, like when I was opening for Doug Stanhope, I was like, oh man, I'm like, they're all his fans. They're here to see him. They might not even pay me any mind at all, but it is like my job to like get in there and break them up a little bit, like a glow stick or something. It's like, I'm not going to wow them. They might be some of my people. They might be people that, you know, they fall in love and follow me afterwards, but like I just have to get them to like me and warm up a little bit. So that's a challenge. But at the same time, if you do well, like the laughs are bigger, you're like, wow, like I'm going to be okay. If you have like a really small show, that could be challenging too. I mean, I've done stand up for just when I was starting out, like, you know, like just a handful of people, like 10 or less. You have a lot of shows or mics that are like that, and you're just like, oh boy, like I am like I can address every single person in this room, you know.
Chrissy, I was in New York once, and it was a snowstorm, Upper West Side. It wasn't the Comedy Cellar. It was the one on 72nd or 79th. There were six people in the crowd, and it was awkward, and it was weird because, I mean, how do you go about doing that? 10 people in a crowd, it's sort of like that's a Christmas family gathering, and you have to be as fresh and authentic, and you can't look bored. You can't look discouraged. How do you go about performing for 10 people?
Yeah, you have to loosen up. You have to like right away be like, okay, this is not going to be the set that you're going to tape and send somewhere. This is not going to be on your like best of reel. But at the same time, like I would never shame. A lot of comics would be like, oh, you guys suck. There's so few of you. What's going on? Like you're frustrated, obviously, because you want a bigger crowd. And then, you know, comics are all like a little bit insecure about something because you're like the gears are turning like, oh, I'm not as big of a draw. Or like, oh, like it could be a showcase. You could be, you know, hopefully you're not headlining to six people, because then maybe you're not ready because you're not that much of a draw. But like, yeah, you're always a little bit insecure if it's a small crowd, because you're like, oh, this is now you feel like more seen. You feel more vulnerable. So in that instance, I would just like talk to them like friends, like just sort of take it down a notch, get a little bit more casual. And like then I would really go into the crowd, like I would, you know, and then you kind of have to just lower the stakes with yourself. You're like, okay, this isn't going to be like a banger set. Like just, you know, no matter if the crowd is big or small, it's like, it is my job to entertain these people and have them walking away being like, wow, we had a better time for having come seen her. You know, you just want them to have a good time. And and if I can make people kind of like come together and laugh at me, it's like, well, then they've, you know, forgotten about their own problems for a night. Or maybe they walk away going, man, I thought I had problems. Like listening to her makes me feel so much better. So, yeah.
Now, when you first started doing it, or even to date, do you ever get stage fright, nervous, anxiety? You're out there on the stage, you're exposed, you're telling people personal stories to try to get a laugh. Usually, I mean, to start out, you may not have any idea what the reaction will be. What has that process been like?
Yeah, like I would be lying if for even like the biggest shows, still even now, I'm not a little bit nervous, but you do have to tell yourself like, I'm not nervous, I'm excited. And you have to turn these feelings positively and you have to get hyped up. And you just for knowing yourself for years, like for me, I know I can have one drink to be a little loose, but more than that, I risk getting a little bit out of control and like less sharp. So you need to know like chemically what to do with yourself. You need to like, some people stretch, some people like listen to music. Some people are just in their notes before a show. Some people don't even look at their notes. They're just talking to people. And sometimes I'm a little like shut down and antisocial before a show because I'm like so focused. And then afterwards, it could be like a completely different person. Then I'm friendly and the pressure's off. But yeah, it's mostly, you're good at feeling nerves because it's, it feels important. It feel every show is important, but if it's like a ton of people or right, like I'm opening for somebody I really respect, well then you're like, okay, like just, but at the end of the day, like I've been doing this for 11 years. Like I know which jokes are going to do well. So even if you try something new and it doesn't go over, you know what to pull out of your back pocket to, you know, get them back again.
One thing that I, a phobia that I have is offending people either inadvertently or deliberately, but less so deliberately. But when you're doing stand-up comedy and it has to walk a line in order to be funny, especially with smaller crowds, but just in general, when you engage with the crowd, do you have any legitimate, any serious concerns about actually offending someone or actually saying something that just crosses a line with the crowd in the pursuit of humor?
I totally understand this question. I think I do a really good job of finding where the line is. And like my particular style is to like be charming. And even like if I have a real tough customer, a real tough cookie, like I will always try to like maybe flirt or charm my way into this person's heart. And just the crowd kind of observing that can be entertaining. But yeah, I never play it safe. Like I have this joke about I usually do it when I'm in Texas and I'm like, oh, I was here, da da da. Like, and I bring up Mexicans. And then if it gets a little quiet, I'm like, what are you guys all Mexicans? And then I'll just point to really anybody. I'll be like, or if someone doesn't laugh, what are you guys Mexican? And then, you know, whether they say yes or no, it doesn't matter. I'm like, oh, wow, I'm a big fan of your work. Like if you step in it a little bit, I feel like there's always a way to get a little bit out of it, sort of like charm or flirt your way out of it. Just to like let people know, like, okay, you're kidding. But I've never had like a crazy heckler. I've never had anybody like throw anything at me on stage. I was once doing a show at like the Atlantic City like beer festival. Someone threw a sandwich at my friend. We were doing stand-up like by the porta potties. I think it was called like Shitty Jokes. That was like one of my favorite, but like also worst gigs ever, because like we're just entertaining people like waiting in line to use porta potties. And they were like, yeah, each of you do an hour. I don't know. Like, we're here for this whole convention. Like, just make it work. That was like also one of the best times. And she was talking about how she was like a Vikings fan. All of a sudden there was like a Subway sandwich coming in her face. So luckily I've never had anything thrown at me. No, you know, you always see clips online, like, oh, a fight breaks out, or, you know, a drunk guy comes up on stage, like, how dare you? Like, thank God nothing like that has happened to me, because I don't think I could fight off like a person. But yeah, I think I do a good job of just like, I go right up to the edge. I'm not like graphic. I don't like talk about my like body in a graphic way, but I definitely like to push buttons. I don't know if that answers the question.
It seems that that's instinctive with most comedians, that's something they've had innately from the beginning. And the other thing is broad curiosity. You have to be widely conversant. You know, it's not a surprise to me that a lot of comedians more easily transition into dramatic acting, into other careers like Joe Rogan, because in order to really be a good comedian, you need to know a lot. You need to know it about a lot. Maybe you don't need to know a lot about a lot, but you need to know enough about a lot and be able to spot insights that others miss to be able to find that comedic strike. Now, just speaking of what Viva was talking about, I've always been intrigued. It's a Woody Allen movie, first time I saw it, that said tragedy plus time equals comedy, which I'm curious what you think about that, because it was explained to me. I was like, oh, that's why my joke didn't go over about Kobe Bryant. I needed a little more time. Is that true, or how much, or is that just sort of something else?
It's so true. It's not only time, but like you need to know what your spin is. You need to know what your take is, and you definitely have to have punchlines formed. A perfect example of this is like the day my mother died, which was like 3 years ago. Like I had spots in the city. Like I was like, well, I knew this was coming, right? She had terminal brain cancer. I knew this day would come. I was like talking myself into, I should still be able to do these shows. And I go into the city to do my shows and woo, I recorded it. It's like still on my phone somewhere. I was trying to do a set and like, it just came out like, oh, my mom died today. But I really didn't have a punchline. I just was still in it. Like I was kind of still in shock. And I think the crowd was like, oh my God, is she okay? Like, I just was like, I'm like, no, it's okay. It was just brain cancer. Like I was just being truthful, but without like an edge, without a turn, without a punchline. So in that case, like you definitely need the time to be like, okay, what is going to be my take on this? But it was raw. That was fresh. Like I definitely should have given myself the night off.
I mean, so on this line as well, is there any word, any joke that's just outright off limits for a joke? And is there any subject matter that would just be off limits?
No, nothing is off limits. Like for me personally, I know like the words that I don't like to say because they're not like fun for me. And it's like the risk of the word is not worth the punchline. It just is like not in my nature to curse a ton. I mean, I've probably cursed a lot already just on this podcast, but like on stage, I don't try to be that dirty. Like I'm not trying to be shocking. Like I'm not saying the N word. I'm not saying like pussy. Like I really, that's not my nature. But I think no words are off limits. No, subject matter is off limits. It's just all about like, do you get a laugh? Like the only joke that should not be told is the one that doesn't get a laugh. Like the audience is your gauge. And that is what's tricky about like Twitter. You don't necessarily know how many people are laughing, but like, I guess likes are a good indication. But I just think once you start saying, oh, we can't make groups jokes about this group of people. Oh, you can't make jokes about this group of people. You start, the walls start closing in on free speech and creativity. It will always be stifled when that happens.
I forget who's made the point, but somebody's made the point that you see in totalitarian societies, no comedy. There's no comedy in a totalitarian society. Now, to what extent, like a lot of comedians were some of the first people to come out and say, there's something going wrong on college campuses, that this woke stuff is insanity, that, you know, it just wasn't Bill Burr dealing with hecklers in Philly. This was a whole different animal taking place. When did you first begin to witness that?
Oof. Yeah. I remember one of the last college gigs I did, like I didn't take a stand, like I'm never doing colleges again. But I remember I performed at the show in Rutgers and I just felt like I wasn't even that much older than these kids. Like, I think I was probably like 27 or 28, maybe I was even 30. And I just was like, there feels like such a disconnect. Like, I don't think I've experienced that much more life than these guys. And I just felt like I wasn't able to like get them to hear me. And then again, maybe it was like, we were in this huge, very brightly lit auditorium. Like the acoustics weren't great. So it might've been like, you know, partly the venue, but I was starting to feel like, oh man, like they're not really listening. They're just sort of like basically like, you know, Dennis the Menace energy. Like we're going to like make your life harder on purpose. But I have noticed that just, you know, in the times I've performed in New York City, like it's so different. And the more, that's why I enjoy performing like all over the country a lot more. And especially now it's perfect because I'm not performing anywhere with a vax mandate. So most of the places in New York City are out for me. And sometimes I go, oh, did I make the right decision? And then I'm like, yeah, of course I did. Like, this is my hill to die on right now. This is very important to me. But yeah, and then I'll go to, I think it's really helpful to just go all over the country. And then you realize like, we're not all so different after all. There are some comics, they just make their whole career that they can do 10 minutes in New York and then they'll go to LA. They'll just go back and forth between like New York City and LA. And they kind of see the whole rest of the country as like an icky flyover state and like wouldn't dare. And then you go to these other states and you're like, oh, we're all the same. Like, what's the big deal?
I'll get one here. I have a question. The economics of being a stand-up comic. I mean, I guess the question is this, like, I fundamentally, how do people make their money in this? How do you survive? When you're a stand-up comic, are you also a working actor? Do you also do other acting gigs, commercial gigs, you know, paid promotions to survive? Or is being a stand-up comic sort of like a separate art unto itself within the broader performing arts that you don't do acting and stand-up comedy when you're trying to pursue live stand-up comedy? How do you make it work? How does it work for the most part? Do you have an agent? And how do people actually succeed at making a living doing this?
everyone is so different with their careers and how they make money. And it's really all over the map. And just the how much it's changed since even like the early aughts to now. It used to be like the 80s and 90s. Like if you were talented, boom, you would get swooped up, picked up. You could get scouted at a club. You'd get an agent. Like things would all come together. You get your late night spot. But man, it's like... It's harder in a way, but ultimately better because now all the gatekeepers of comedy have sort of been diluted out. Like the fact that we all have a little promotional tool in our back pocket now, like you can make your whole career just on social media. And it doesn't matter if you live in a big comedy city or not. Like if you know how to market yourself, that's kind of really all that matters. Tyler Fisher is a really good example. He is a friend that I had him on my podcast recently. He's an actor. In fact, I was like watching Chicago MD this summer and I saw him. I'm like, oh, he's like, he played the role of like this jockey with an eating disorder. I'm like, that's Tyler Fisher. And he's a very serious, very good actor. And in fact, an article just came out like today or yesterday that he is part of this new movie that Gina Carano is doing. They're filming it right now out in Montana. Samir Armstrong is in it. Nick Searcy is doing it. And this is going to be like the first big project Gina has done since getting fired from Disney, since The Mandalorian. So I was so excited to see him in that. And he is just someone who's like serious actor, also did stand up. And his agents were telling him like, sorry, it's just a tough time to be a white guy. Like just the work was drying up. They're like, we're not going to give you opportunities. Like we're just because I understand like these agents, they know what's not going to work right now. And, you know, it's a horrible system. And he's a very talented guy. And he was just like, not that long ago, he was feeling kind of hopeless about his career. And now it's like, he's on this project with Gina Carano. I'm like so happy for him. So some comics do, you know, they do the actor thing as well. Some comics have rich parents. Anytime you're like, oh, you meet a comic and you're like, they just started and they live in Manhattan. You're like, I smell rich parents. Like, wait, what's happened? Okay. And then part of you is like kind of jealous of that because you're like, oh, you don't have to like slave away behind a desk for 40 hours a week. Like, and then you get over it and you're like, life is just tough. Like, you know what I mean? You don't have to be doing stand up. Like you can go choose an easier path, you know? And some
did you ever have an interest in acting or no?
I did a little bit like when I was doing improv, like the popular thing to do when you're doing like UCB comedy is also to do like commercial auditions because, you know, I'd see so many improv people like in commercials just like throughout the whole time I was doing improv. I'd be like every other commercial, I'd be like, oh, I know that guy. So I would go on a lot of auditions and like I went for a long time, even paid for like commercial acting classes. You know, you get the headshots. It's like, it's exhausting. And I just was, it's a ton of rejection, but I would still do it. And then I found stand up and I was like, okay, I just don't have time to do these auditions. And I wasn't finding like much success with it. Like maybe I did like a couple of short films or something. I think I got this one gig like modeling for stock photos. Like I had like a stethoscope and I wore like a lab coat. It was insane. I was like, I don't look like a doctor. I'm not fooling anybody. So you get just like random gigs. Like I remember I had a foot modeling job at one point. I found it on Craigslist. I went there half thinking like I'm about to have like several men jerking off on my feet. Like I don't even know if this is a legit gig. And thank God I got there and it was for real. And I learned like so much like, wow, like if you're a size 7 foot, like you're the industry standard size. Like I thought every size had a foot model. It's like, no, it's just the one size 7. And it was not glamorous at all. It was like $50 an hour, but then they would see me for like 15 minutes at a time and they'd be like, okay, done. We're good now. I'd be like, oh, this is like no money. Yeah. Some comics also do a corporate day job. Some comics are like the classic, like they're a barista or they're like a waiter or waitress or bartender. So every combination, you know, there's some comics who were like also teachers and then, you know, the degree to which you have to keep your day job life and your real life secret can sometimes be stressful. Like I remember one of my jobs was like, I worked in admissions for an all boys prep school on the Upper East Side. And that job started at 8 a.m. I had to be at my desk at 8 a.m. And then, you know, you're out doing comedy and stuff till like 2 a.m. It's just like exhausting. But
you know, how much did like in L.A., west side of L.A., kind of the joke is that pretty much almost every waiter, waitress, or bartender is a disappointed or seeking actor or actress. How much of that is true in New York to any degree, like in Manhattan? How much are people wanting to be on, are there because they want to be on Broadway, want to be in comedy, want to be in TV? How much is it, is that, it doesn't feel like it when I'm there, but I'm not, I can't, you know, I don't live there.
I think the stereotype, it's like with acting, it's more likely, I think, that you will be like waiter, waitress, bartender, right? Because like if your auditions are during the day, then it kind of makes more sense for you to be like bartending at night. But with comedy, like same thing, like our gigs are at night. So, you know, we need to kind of find a day job as well. And then some people work nights. So it's, but I feel like more with acting, you're going to have waiter, waitress, bartender. Whereas with comedy, you could be waiter, waitress, bartender, but also like a variety of any other random. A lot of comics are dog walkers. A lot of them are babysitters. So yeah.
Christy, I got to ask you the question. I mean, it's not to gossip, but when we talk about confession through projection, when you hear a lot of the jokes that comedians have been making and you find out that by and large, there's a lot of truth to them. I'm thinking of Seth MacFarlane on I forget which award show it was, talking about Harvey Weinstein. You talk about Louis C.K. talking about his defense mechanism. If nobody's seen this, it was a Louis C.K. bit where he said, wouldn't it be funny if humans had the same defense mechanism as skunks, where like, you know, you spray a liquid to scare off predators, and the liquid was whatever. And he's like, you're in an elevator and you just do that and you scare somebody off. And then you find out that Louis C.K. has been doing similar things. And I say this with minimal judgment, just like there was truth to that joke. How many of the stand-up comics in real life are actual moral degenerates who actually do a lot of the stuff they joke about, whereas it's not actually just absurd humor, it's sort of something of confession? Is that a massive tendency in the industry?
That's such a good question. And I was listening to Giannis Pappas. He just did Michaela Peterson's podcast, and I think he described it pretty well. He's like, I've noticed there are two types of people who do stand up. The ones that are like kind of sociopathic. They like to control. They need it for their ego. I mean, like all comics to a degree need it for their ego, but they're more just like, I'm telling you what's funny. Like this, it's going this way. And then you have your like super empathetic comics who really more want to be about connection. They want to like, you know, be more present, I think, and kind of like join everyone together. I feel like I fall into that category more, but I've definitely like, you know, I've dated a lot of comics and I've definitely dated some that fall into the other category. Wait, what was your question?
No, the question is like, how many of them in practice are actually not good people? If we phrase it that way.
It's so tricky. And I never thought, I was like, oh, stand-ups are all great until some of them started to come after me, until like some of them started to cancel me. And I was like, oh, this is a very competitive industry. It is every man for themselves. Like there's not really a comedy community because everyone sees you as their competition. Like I was so lucky and blessed to find Compound Media because I truly feel like those guys are my brothers and I've stuck my neck out for them and they for me. But I think that was, I think in 2008 was when I really, or was it? Yes. 2018 was when I really learned like, oh, cause I had this like woke kind of SJW comic rally all of her like friends and fans after me, after I did an impression of her. It's insane. It's like, we're all public figures. We even had this show every year called Shtick or Treat, where we impersonate like comics who are more famous than us. Like I did Michelle Wolf a few, like that very same year. So, but then when I saw the degree to which like I was, it was like a witch hunt. Like people were coming after me and kind of like smearing my name a bit. Like I know I definitely, like there are some folks at Comedy Central or in certain late night positions who after, you know, hearing from her, like she was in their ear. And I feel like that definitely put up a few walls for me, but I think everything happens for a reason. And these obstacles were put in my place so that I could really find my path and then, and fight for free speech. Like I am now, I feel like if I had it, you know, the easy way and things were coming to me and like, I was a Comedy Central darling or getting on every late night show. Like it's kind of, this path has kind of like, you know, I don't know. It's made me see the reality of how like woke leftist Hollywood and like the comedians that sort of make it are hand in hand. And it, I don't know. I guess it's made me angrier and like I'm seeing the truth more. And I just feel like it's all kind of meant to be. But to like actually answer your question of like how many stand-up comics are terrible people, it's tricky. It's like there's definitely good and bad people, as I'm sure there are with any industry. But it's you know, we're definitely mouthier than any, you know, you don't hear about like the shitty pilots because they're not like talking about it on podcasts or on stage. So
how much is stolen jokes a problem in the comedy industry?
Gosh, I don't know. Like you always hear, you know, they made a big thing of it when Amy Schumer took a bunch of jokes for her Inside Amy Schumer show, or maybe even with some of her specials. I remember when I was brand new, I did a joke and then someone, I think on social media, reached out to me. Oh, Jamie Lee, this other stand-up comic, Jamie Lee, has a very similar joke to you. And then I just kind of stopped doing it. And that's the only instance that happened. And the joke was like, oh, you know, guys ask me all the time, like, since I have red hair, do the carpets match the drapes? And I say, no, actually, I have hardwood floors. And it's so funny because in Dave Chappelle's special, he's talking about his opener. And he's saying, this was so surreal. Like I'm watching this special and he was talking about his transgendered opener and she says the same joke and he says it in the special. And I was like, oh my God, like part of me was like, that's my joke. And then I'm like, wait a minute. No, this is parallel thinking. I'm sure a lot of people have had that joke. It's not all that clever. But I just was like, oh, that's so funny.
Well, that's the problem. And I want to quote Abe Simpson, but I don't remember the exact quote, but the fax machine is nothing but a waffle iron with a toaster attached to it, whatever it was. Like some of these things, they're just reflexive answers under contextual questions that people will have instantaneously, simultaneously thought of. How much genuine, bona fide joke pirating is there? Because the thing about Amy Schumer, I remember seeing the montage. It's pretty pathological, but even the jokes that she was alleged to have stolen, they were not all that original in the first place, where I doubt the person who was alleged to have been stolen from thought them up themselves. So like, are there known serial joke stealers in the industry that everyone knows to be careful for?
I remember hearing like Carlos Mencia was doing it a lot. Of course, like heard about it in the context of like Amy Schumer with her show and maybe some specials, but you're like, is that parallel thinking? And then you heard this clip of Amy Schumer, like she was, I think, on Howard Stern. And the way she was like, she came off while she was defending herself made me go, oh, like she's coming off very defensive and kind of shitty, which makes me think that she did know, but it could just be how she came off. Through doing certain road gigs, like, I have a good friend that's like, oh, when you go to this club out in Jersey, like the local guy, like you'll hear, like he does a couple of my bits and then you're like, oh shit. Yeah. And then you'll work the road and you'll be like, this sounds familiar. Like, is this a Joe DeVito bit? Is this like, I heard a little bit through the grapevine that like Vic DiBattista had stolen some jokes. He is like a big local, like is very big also, like Long Island, tri-state area. So you hear a little bit here and there. You'll never hear somebody like copy someone's whole set. I mean, that would be insane. But once in a while, maybe like a joke here or there. People are usually it's so looked down upon that if even one person tells you, oh, that's somebody else's joke. For me, like, go back to the well, get another bucket out. Like, you don't need to be married to any of these jokes, or tweak it in a way that makes it even more specific to you. Like, break it up. You know what I mean? Break it up and then mix it up again with something else.
Now when did sort of the political awakening for you come about, in the sense of what was happening to comedy, what was happening to, you know, broader culture? How did you cross over into that space?
That was also happening in 2018, after I was the like attempted canceling by this other female stand-up. That was like a big awakening for me, because I was like, oh, wow. And even before that, like in 2012, the owner of this club in Long Island City at the time, like, and you realize like these beefs in comedy, a lot of it is just so personal and there's nothing you could have done. And it's just like, holy shit, like this woman banned me from her club because she got so upset that I was dating a guy that she used to date. And even still to this day, 2021, like, you know, I'm still blocked and everything. It's crazy. I've tried reaching out, emails, but 2018 was really part of my political awakening. I attribute a lot of this to Larry Sharp. I would say he's responsible for like yellow pilling me, because he He ran for the Libertarian candidate for governor of New York City in 2018. And my boyfriend's brother was working on his campaign. So that's how I came to meet him. And just like, he broke open my whole mind. Like, I was beginning to kind of come out of my leftist sort of like college brainwashing.
But Chrissy, I'm sorry. Given earlier discussion, what is the yellow pill?
Pilling, I think, is when someone turns you libertarian.
Okay. Okay. I didn't know if there was something more humorous about it.
Well, there's so like, I know the blue red pill, black pill, white pill. There's a lot of pills, I guess.
So what's the deal? Now, I'm seeing this a lot. The Psaki or Psaki impression. Look, FNT. Oh, yeah. It took me a while to realize they're talking about Friday Night Tights. But Chrissy, what happened on Friday Night Tights that everybody in the chat's talking about?
Oh, God. Yeah, that's a great show. In fact, I'm on it this Friday. Look, literally, this was a $20 investment. Yeah, I've done the Jen Psaki. I was on Elijah Fisher's show at The Blaze, Slightly Offensive. I did her there, and then I've done her on Friday Night Tights. And it's just like, it's pretty simple. Like, it's just this wig. I wear a little bit less makeup, and I wear like a bright blue or bright green top. And then I just have to like listen to her voice. This is obviously not working right now.
It's already good.
I have to listen to her voice for a little bit just to like, because she has such a monotone, like I want... Yeah, I don't know if I can do it right now. I have to listen to her, but she's very boring, and she just has sort of dead. I have to get a deadness behind my eyes, and just a lot of circling back.
With Psaki, other than the circling back, it's, and I'm not saying this to be mean. If I were a stand-up comic, it would be my observation. It's the tongue. There's a movement with the tongue that I don't know. I don't know why it happens. I guess it's a nervous thing, or the mouth is dry. Well, it's more like that. And I know that I have a thing where I also have to swallow in between sentences. So I'm aware of my own. There was one.
I think that's an anxious public speaking tick.
Yeah.
Because I've seen her do it.
You know, it could be. I think the body language panel has an interpretation of that. They say that jutting the tongue means something negative, I thought. Like it's actually kind of contempt for the audience. Or, you know, I mean, sometimes it can be just licking your lips because of, you know, saliva issues. But if she does that regularly, that would be interesting to break down.
Yeah. Every time Ducey shows up, she's like, guy.
When she starts a question, it's almost, I don't want to say a lizard like tongue, cause that has connotations well beyond what I mean, but it's like, and then she starts talking.
Yeah, they call it that in a snake tongue. That's what it's, and I think it means something negative that they would know better, but I've heard them reference it like 5 or 6 times. Speaking of which, for imitations. So you were describing how you go about it for Psaki or whatever her name is. How are you pronouncing it? But is that how you do it for everybody? And what were some of your early favorite imitations to do?
Yeah, I have to just like, you just like listen. I would listen to like YouTube. God, and it was like one of the most boring impressions to learn. Cause I'm like, she just never says anything fun. Like she isn't fun. And just like, okay, it's obviously the look, getting the look down as best that you can. And then with Psaki, I'm like, okay, I have to make her a little bit fun. Cause if I'm just doing a straight Psaki, no one's going to laugh. So for her, it's like, okay, maybe she just like lets out her real feelings, or like maybe she starts hitting on one of the reporters, or just, she's like, you know, you just have to like throw in little like interesting twists there. But yeah, usually like I did an impression of Michelle Wolf. Like, again, you just listen, like, hi Brooklyn, oh my god, it's so good to see you, some of you, I guess. And it just, you know, she was kind of hot a few years ago, you know, I haven't heard much from her lately. And a lot of the impressions I've done are just, I did a Greta Thunberg impression.
Oh boy, speaking of getting canceled.
With her impression, it was just like, I was like, for her, like, she's so constricted. She's so like tight, you know, I was like, what would she say if she was saying the quiet part out loud? And for her, she's like, this is because nobody will eat with me at lunch, you know, like adding in a few like truthful, like she's still at the time, like whatever she was, 16
years old.
So like, let's make her sound like a real 16-year-old, because who she's trying to be now is like, let's pretend like, so someone's putting her up to this.
I'm going to bring this one up because this is funny. On 4chan, I heard someone say the first red pill is a suppository. In my experience, it's true. Chrissy just said hers, but what was yours, gents? My first one was not the suppository, but lately they have become more and more suppository-like. Wait until tonight's vlog comes out when you realize that once you realize mainstream media has been lying to you, you realize they've always been lying to you. It's not something new. And then you just reassess your entire existence. But Christy, now getting into getting canceled, because this is something that everybody sort of realizes. I did it again now. Now I'm conscious about my own swallowing. People ultimately realize this, that you think they were your friends, but they were your allies. And when you have allies, you have no friends. And this, I don't know who you were talking with. I forget now on your channel. And I found it to be the most insightful thing is that when you live in a world with no friends, but only allies, allies flip at the switch of an ideological difference. Friends will stay with you through it. So that's how has that been your observation? What do you make of that? And flesh it out for anyone who didn't hear the beautiful idea of when you live in a world of allies, there is no friendship.
Oh, yeah. Because, again, I came out of college in 2005. I started stand-up like 2010. Again, very much a leftist, SJW, just by default setting. Feminist, of course. Of course you love gay people. Of course you want them to live their lives. Like, why would, you know, kind of like a reaction to like Bush era Republicanism, you know, like, oh, your parents are Republican. I'm going to be cool and with it and like modern. And one of the first shows I produced was at the Stonewall Inn, gay landmark, New York City and national landmark. I ran a show there for 6 years, tons of gay friends. I had a blast. Like we had, you know, there'd be like drag shows in between, made me a better host, a better producer. I had like the best time, but I noticed, once I got the show on Compound Media, which a lot of people think is this like very, you know, right wing network. And they, you know, whatever people think of Anthony Cumia, because he was sort of canceled, you know, before it was even cool. But a lot of people, you know, Gavin McGinnis used to have a show there. Oh, my God. You know, people are very confused about how the Proud Boys came to be. They were actually started over of a joke. They were trying to get one of the technical booth boys like late or whatever. And Gavin was just saying like, hey, just like, don't masturbate, buy a leather jacket, just, you know, trying to help them be cool, basically. And then it turned into this like answer to Antifa or whatever. So a lot of people were so confused about Compound Media, had like very, you know, a bad, wrong impression of it. And so once I got my show on Compound Media, it was the same time that I had to drop my show at the Stonewall Inn. And these two kind of were at comedic, I guess, like, kind of like odds with each other in a sense. Like there's like the leftist sort of, and then that crowd is bigger in comedy, especially like in New York and LA. It's
Chrissy,
like,
sorry, did you have to drop the Stonewall because of ideological differences or just because of timing?
Yes,
scheduling?
Ideological was the word I was looking for. I had to drop the Stonewall show because I had just a very hard time. You know, Stonewall Inn is not like a comedy venue, and it was pretty amazing that I was able to do a show there for 6 years straight, because, you know, understandably, the manager of the spot is not really like, he doesn't really care about comedy, honestly. Like, he could cancel my show at the drop of the hat and he'd be like, oh, sorry, like, we have an urgent Madonna sing-along that has to happen next week on your show date. Like, sorry, could you just, and I like fought for that Saturday night show, and he'd be like, oh, can you just move it to the Wednesday? Because he would see I would get this really great crowd on a Saturday night, and he'd be like, oh, can you just do that on a worse night? Like, can you do that on a Tuesday for me, on a Wednesday? And I was like, it doesn't really work like that. Like, I have comics coming from the Cellar, which is a quick walk away. Like, I scout the city for, you know, up and coming LGBT talent. So I can't really just move everybody. So I felt ultimately a little bit like disrespected, and it was kind of more work. And I felt, and even though I did that for 6 years, I really didn't get very many opportunities out of it. It wasn't like, oh, come host a pride parade thing. Like, and that was exactly the thing. Like, you have a lot of allies, but I wasn't getting very much out of it. I had a ton of people in my messages, oh, book me for the show. A lot of, you know, leftists being nice to me because they wanted to get on this really great show that I produced. But the moment I realized, okay, I can't do both, I'm going to drop this show and I'm going to go for this bigger opportunity, you know, and do this podcast for Compound Media. Ideological at odds with each other. It's almost like people are like, oh, she's turning to the alt-right away from doing this gay show. And it was, and just like that, you know, certain people don't talk to me anymore. Certain people aren't nice to me anymore. And I'm the same person with the same sense of humor. But when I went from Stonewall Inn to Compound Media, it was really like a life lesson for me. I was like, oh, wow. Like, but I'm still the same. But people don't care about that. They're just like, oh, can you help me or not? And is associating with you going to help my career or not?
So how much, yeah, I was curious, how much was New York like LA? Because like I used to say in LA, it's, how are you? What can you do for me? Because it was such a transactional culture. I mean, that and everybody's a narcissist. I said I could set up a shrink office, just put a tape recorder in and give everybody the accurate diagnosis. Though you figure out, like you were mentioning, you almost have to be a narcissist to stay and succeed because you get rejected so many times. Who goes through 200 rejections and thinks the next one, I will be the great one? Yet you either have to be really idealistic or a narcissist. But how much is New York that transactional culture? Because I think people from outside of New York or LA, and DC's this way too, it's totally foreign. It's not what you grow up with. It's not what you're accustomed to. And you often, you know, end up in very distorted, you know, unlikable situations. It's one of the sort of social shock that leads a lot of people to flee. Like New York, I remember looking up years ago, it's like, has a disproportionate number of young women. Like there's like 3-to-1 ratio amongst people under 30 are wow. female to male, because there's this imagery, this idealism about New York. How much is transactional culture kind of dominant in the aspects that you dealt with?
I think the reason for more women in New York City is like it's the fashion capital, right? And there's so many media companies, like the big magazines. Kind of, I mean, now the magazine industry is dying, but like those are like kind of based in New York. And a lot of women that like dream of right, like they want to go to FIT and work in fashion, like they're in New York, right? And then you have all Broadway, and so I think it attracts a lot of like chick industries. But then of course you have like finance, so. It's interesting because I noticed the camaraderie among comics from cities that are not New York or LA, like Philly comics or Boston. They will help each other out. They'll sort of like, all right, there's five of us. We all came up in Boston. We're all going to move to New York City together or LA together. And, you know, maybe some of us move there first. And then when the other guys can come in a couple of years, like we got their backs, we'll help them get on shows. There's like a bond there. They help each other out. But I mean, I started in New York City because I'm from Long Island, so I didn't really feel that. And they say it's rougher because, you know, when you start your newer years in New York City, like people are seeing you sucking more and bombing because you're new. Where the ideal situation would be like start in a Boston or a Philly or whatever, get good there, and then come to New York City and like really shine. But I just like didn't do that. Whereas, you know, it's interesting because like New York City and LA were the very competitive like comedy cities. But your point about kind of being more of like a shallow Hollywood thing, that is kind of more the case in LA, whereas stand-up is New York City feels like the stand-up city. It's like stand-ups are grittier. They're kind of like more real people rather than, you know, actors or actors that are like trying their hand at comedy, and then where their agent tells them to start doing stand-up, and you can see right through those people right away.
Yeah. I'm bringing this one because this is beautiful. Someone says politics is like a cesspool. The turd always flows to the top. There's the expression, the cream rises to the top. And I had my own expression, which is similar to this, is that no matter how far down the poop falls, the odor still flows to the top. But the transactional thing, Robert, it's interesting. I'm trying to compare it to the industries or the areas where I've had personal experience. And there's transactional stuff everywhere. It's just a question of variance as to whether or not it's the majority, you know, 50-50 or the minority. I think life is transactional. It's just a question of how people know or don't know how to deal with other people. But like,
well, what's unique in LA is you meet somebody random and it's transactional. I mean, it's not like it was within the business setting. You go to a random party, 2/3 of the conversations are transactional. I mean, I was like, people had told me this, but it was still shocking to actually experience it because I could understand it within a certain sector. But what it is everything in LA is about the entertainment industry. Everything in everything in DC is about politics, and parts of New York, everything's about if you're in the media or fashion industry or about that. And because they're there for that, everything they see in their life, it can be transactional and it can be kind of jarring to deal with it if you're not prepared for it.
It can make cynical. That's why it's so good to like go to a North Carolina, go to a Florida, like be around nice people and just sort of like air out a little bit, because like we developed this thick skin like just to survive in like a New York City, and then you leave it and you're like, oh, I don't need it. Like, why am I? People think I'm like a cunt, but it's like, oh no, this is just like my tortoise like shell that I've had to grow.
Well, and that's the other, when I first got to New York, people told me, don't smile at people. Don't greet people randomly. That, you know, it was like a Moscow introduction to Moscow was don't smile at people who think you're crazy. how much is New York still that way? Because, I mean, I grew up in the South, so I didn't really believe people, and then I experienced them. People got mad at me, for I was like, this is the weirdest thing. I was like 12 at the time, but it was still weird. Is New York still that way, a little bit of a tough city where you learn to be guarded to survive, and so that breeds a very different, what's seen from outsiders as a rough, coarse culture?
Okay, so pre-pandemic, like, it totally depends on what neighborhoods you're in. Like, the, you know, typical, like, working young professional, live on the Upper East Side, work downtown or whatever. Like, they're probably just, like, they're going the same route. They're probably not putting themselves, they know what neighborhoods not to go into. You know, pre-pandemic, like, Trump, even Bloomberg, like, New York was, like, very safe. But I can only speak from, like, my experience as a stand-up comic, like, for years, like, all hours of the night, to and from Brooklyn, every subway, every hour of the night, all the trains, all the buses, you know, if I was feeling like a little bit YOLO, take a cab. I do kind of learn, and I would like perform stand up in a dress and heels. So you learn, okay, like, I'm wearing my sneakers and I have my heels in my bag. Like, if depending on the neighborhood, okay, I'm wearing my hair back. I'm doing a hoodie. You just, like, you know what I mean? I'm just trying to not look as flashy as possible. I'm not trying to be like this, you know, bright. I don't know why I had to do that.
If that hoodie were red, it would have been the scene from that movie, Don't Look Now, which is an old one. But, there's people in there who don't seem to like New York anymore. My experience with New York pre-pandemic, because I haven't left the country in 2 years, New York was felt like a big family, community living. Everybody was nice, talkative, but I only saw it as the Canadian who would travel down from time to time and get that experience. So I can't imagine how frustrating it is as a local person, someone who lives there, to live in a small apartment, to pay taxes up the wazoo, to struggle to eke out an existence, and basically to be landlocked onto an island where you are stuck. But it does make for good comedy. It does make for good life experiences. And was it Woody Allen that said, live in New York long enough to build character, but not long enough to crush your soul?
Wow, that's good. That sounds like something he would say. Yeah, it was great pre-pandemic. Like, it was, but the pandemic showed everybody, like, wow, all the reasons that you are putting up with New York City, like, all the positives gone, all the negatives brought to the surface, you know, small apartment, you're finally facing your roommates, you know, I had apartments, like, well, never in Manhattan, but like Brooklyn and Astoria. I lived in Harlem once with like a boyfriend for like 6 months or something. But, you know, you live there because you're there for whatever's going on in the city. It's like you go home literally to fall asleep, wake up, and then you're out of there. It's like, how much time can you spend away from your apartment? And that's how you justify, like, oh, I'm here for the arts. I'm here to pursue stand up. I'm here to crush it in finance, like, whatever your reason for being in the city is. And then when all of that shut down, people are like, oh, my God, I live in a broom closet. It was
that you're paying dramatic. Out the wazoo for. Mm-hmm.
I was shocked. I was startled because my introduction to New York, aside from being a kid and seeing some crazy things and learning not to smile at people and greet them randomly, but that was in New York that was coming out of the 70s. My introduction was mid 80s and it was still a little edgy. But later when I went to New York, it was, you know, with other projects in college and law school. And, you know, it was going to Tiffany's and doing the whole breakfast at Tiffany's routine. We'd watch the city wake up from 5 to 6 a.m., wait for the food vendor to show up, get, you know, see the activity, and you get this great sort of vibe. And when I went, because I had a case that was partially a product of the pandemic, frankly, when I was there that time, I was like, the city felt heavy. It was like a heavy fog of misery, anger, bitterness. I mean, I was like, this is some of the worst. It was the worst mindset and mentality I'd felt in the city ever. And I could understand why certain things happened with, you know, my client's case. I was like, everybody's on edge here. This is like, the Spike Lee movie, where they're in the summer, everybody's on edge, it gets really hot, and everybody's ready to kill each other in New York. I'm blanking, it's not School Days. I wandered into that movie accidentally.
I can only think of the poetry. What's it called? Freedom of Artistic. Do the right thing.
Yeah, do the right. I think that's it. Do the right thing. People will know in the chat. What is New York like now? Are you staying in New York? I mean, a lot of, and Michael Malice, other people getting out of Dodge. People in the chat talking about wanting to get out of Dodge. What's your sentiment about all that?
I live in Westchester. My like even before the people are upset that we're saying the pandemic, so maybe I'll say the plandemic. pre all that, like my whole
Chrissy, don't say that, or you're gonna get us killed. <here. laughs>
Consult your doctor. Even before all this mess, my whole family like moved away from New York just because they couldn't handle like the taxes and the traffic. Brother went to North Carolina, sister went to Vegas, parents went to Florida, mom died down there, dad's having YOLO time, got an Audi, living his life now. So it was already kind of disjointed before then, and I moved in with my boyfriend. You know, I met him, gosh, wow, like almost 7 years ago, and I've been living in Westchester now like maybe like 4 years. So kind of same distance to the city from Long Island. And, you know, he has a son who's 10 years old, so he really can't leave the state. And then I realized like, okay, like both of our sources of income are tied to this state. And then I also was like, no, I kind of want to like stay and fight. And I also live far away enough from the city where as the city crumbles, it's not really affecting me because I'm still like a commuter. I still can obviously podcast, you know, do kind of road shows. You know, I'm getting a car now. Like, I mean, it was like $100. Somebody died and now I'm getting their car basically for free. But it's very exciting. I could still do like gigs in Jersey, out on Long Island, and, you know, fly to wherever to do road stuff. So yeah, now I'm kind of like, no, I want to stay and fight. Like, yeah, eventually maybe I'll move to like a Florida or Texas, but I feel like I'm far away enough where things are okay. Like you're not feeling the full brunt of like New York City's collapse, you know?
Now, what led to the interest in podcasting?
How did I get interested in it?
Yeah.
Interesting. So I was doing my show on Compound Media. That started in 2019. And I would have like comedians and porn stars on the show because they're fun. And I feel sort of like we both feel like, you know, we're kind of the outcasts in a way of society. We're like society's weirdos kind of, you know, we're in an industry where like it's hard to just go back and like go work at a bank or something. Like you're kind of in it and you're kind of brandished. Is that even the right word? Plus it was fun and, you know, I joke around and stuff. And then I went to the AVN Awards in 2020. This was like, yeah, January 2020. And I was like, you know what? Like, I think I want to start in, yes, it was in Vegas at
yeah,
the.
It usually is. That's a crazy weekend. You have to watch yourself walking around.
Oh my God. If you ever want to go somewhere and feel fat and ugly, the AVN is the place to go. I just was like, oh my God, you know. It's funny. It's so funny. Like we're staying in the hotel and everybody every morning is like waiting in line in the same Dunkin' Donuts in the hotel. And like the girls are just wearing like next to nothing and just like bending over the counter. Like, what should I order? And then like watching the Dunkin' Donuts guy, like watching like poor Paul, that's not his real name, but like keep a straight face and be like, okay, it's just fun. It's like, it's great for people watching. But it was in January 2020 that I realized I want to start. I was like, new year, you know, I'll start a podcast. And I sort of, you know, threw my show, The Wet Spot. And I was like, I kind of want to interview porn stars more because it's interesting. Like, you know, sometimes you talk to one and porn stars get a lot of flack. Like, oh, why are you talking to these girls? They're dumb. Da, da, da. It's like, you know what? Their income is not based on their personality. So some of them aren't the wittiest or the sharpest, but the ones that are and have an interesting backstory, the ones that are mothers, the ones that, you know, I talked to this girl, Allie Ray. She kind of went viral recently because she left her job as an ICU nurse to do OnlyFans. And now she makes like 75K a month. Like she's beautiful. So it's like, I just like to hear the stories. So I figured AVN was a good opportunity to start interviewing some of these girls and like some of the guys too. But it's obviously like more girls. And then I just was like, I was doing it once a week, like most comics do. And then the lockdowns and stuff happened. And it was May of 2020 that I realized like, you know what, like, let me step this up. Like, let me try to do four times a week. Like there's no female comics really, not that I'm trying to be like Joe Rogan. I joked at first, like I'm going to be like Ho Rogan, which is a terrible pun. But I just was like, let me see if I can do multiple times a week and maintain it. And I've been able to, which is great. And I just like started to really love it. And I've been able to meet, you know, people like the two of you and talk to people I normally never would have been able to.
This is an interesting question because is going to get to Howard Stern a little bit. A fuzzy creature. Do you talk to them to be entertained, or are you looking to learn something about life, seeking perspective? And this is interesting because once upon a time, when Howard Stern was funny and before he suffered from TDS, but how, and then pandemic, but how, he used to have these discussions with, call them fringe elements or fringe people of society, because they're definitely not mainstream. And what made the interviews amazing was how insightful they were, non-judgmental, trying to get to know the person without trying to judge the person for who they were, how he has changed to the point where I can now live without him on Siri radio. But Chrissy, I mean, I think I know the answer, and I may have fed you part of my what I suspect your answer is going to be, but is it, I mean, it's a good question. Is it to be entertained? Is it to be exploitive? Or is it to actually hear the voices of what is generally regarded as a fringe element of society and a highly judged one at that?
Yeah, I was very attracted to like, that as a group, they're so highly judged and disregarded. Like even there was a time where a comic had, and I'm not shitting on him at all. I think it was a decent podcast, but he had a podcast called like Porn Stars Are People Too. And even that I was like, ugh, like, of course they're people. Like, why is this a thing? And especially in going to AVN, I realized like so many of the guys that show up to these events and conventions that are like media, they're there to hit on these girls. Like they're there to get close to these girls and shoot their shot. And I was just like, I just felt like a sigh of relief almost when I'd be interviewing these girls. I'd be like, oh, it's a chick. Okay. You're not going to try to hit on me. Great. Like you're not, I'm okay if I'm like alone in a room with you or whatever. And I know there's no like ulterior motive. And then you have someone like Holly Randall, who has an amazing podcast. She's a photographer in the adult industry, and she, you know, she interviews the girls as well, and she just does a great job. But yeah, I liked hearing their stories, just kind of like they're dealing with their struggle. I felt like just kind of like a bond. Like I don't know, they're seen so negatively in society. I just was like, no, like they're all sort of people like to paint them with a broad brush, I guess. And even like myself, like this was many years ago, I was in between jobs. I was like on Craigslist. I know, so retro. I was like a sneeze away from sex work myself. And then I was going back and forth with this one job, and then it took too long. And it was like, it was one of these situations where like I was being pretty promiscuous that summer. So I figured like, oh, what's the big deal? Like I'm hooking up anyway. I might as well like make money from it. And you think it's going to be so easy. And I remember like, I was considering, you know, whatever it was, like this guy was like, oh, come over. And it's like me and my four buddies. And like, we'll see what happens or whatever. You'll make $1,000. And I was like, great, rent's due. And then it was like something where like that night I would just like cry, or I'd be like crying in the shower. And I'm like, okay, you need to listen to when these moments happen. Like you need to, if you are like crying in the shower, then take a moment, pause, and just think about what's going on in your life. And just kind of like, not everyone is cut out for this industry, even if you are like a promiscuous person. And for me personally, I felt like had I gone down that path, I would be taking a chunk of my soul and putting it elsewhere. But then you meet women who are not, you know, you don't feel like their soul is damaged in doing this work. They genuinely love sex and it is like a performance. It's kind of like acting in a way. So yeah, it's interesting to meet the ones that are cut out for it and can thrive and provide for themselves and are happy. It's like, it's interesting. It's interesting to talk to these people.
Now, I have a theory that a lot of, you know, the great comedians are great storytellers. And what really unites that in part is that they're naturally curious people. Have you always been naturally curious?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like always big into talking to strangers, like, you know, making friends in lines. And like, I've always been like, I think, good at observing people. And I wonder if that's because like my childhood, like you're kind of just navigating your parents, and maybe I was like tiptoeing around my dad's like anger and temper, and you like, you learn what to do, you know, you have your like child, like, you know, survival instincts or whatever. And I think I remember like growing up. Like, my mom and dad would fight, and then like my dad would go on estimates, whatever. He would just disappear for hours, and then it would be like me and my sister and my mom, and like I could make her laugh, and that would kind of perk her up. And like the sort of unhealthy side of that is like you have a child that feels like it's their job to take care of their parents, and like emotionally, and then you grow up with this thing like, oh, their emotions are my responsibility. Not necessarily the best, whatever. Went to therapy about it. But yeah, I don't even know what I was talking about. I'm like really rambling.
That was good. Now, how did you end up hooking up with the Friday Night Tights crowd?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I think, man, I think they asked me to be on the show once, and I just had such a blast. And I've made like, I feel like such genuinely good friends from that show. Like a couple of the guys from that show like came and saw me live. Like Gary, I think it's his channel, Nerdrotics, like he came and saw me in Vegas at one of the Comedians of the Compound show. And then Quarter Black Garrett came and saw me in Austin, or not Austin, Dallas, when I was headlining down at Hyenas. And it's just, it's incredible that we live in a time where like I've made better friends in the last year and a half than probably my whole life, and like stronger bonds. And I feel like more like a ride or die, but maybe it's also like I've been through so many, like a lot of friends have shed me, you know, I guess for their own, cause I know, you know, I'm not with the, I got kicked out of the woke boat, I guess. But yeah, it's really amazing that like we live in a time where you can really deeply connect and build bonds and friendships with like just your internet friends, you know. And I like the combination of like humor and cultural critique and sort of like nerd world, you know. Like I haven't read every comic book. I up until a point hadn't seen every Star Wars movie, but I liked that they would kind of poke fun at like the intersection of like Hollywood and woke culture. And cause that's something I noticed too, just being in comedy. So just like a shared interest.
Chris, I mean, this is my question. This is maybe more confession through projection, but you're in a field where, you know, relevance is probably the most important thing. At some point in time, if you feel that you're not relevant, you feel that you're not in the limelight, that you become irrelevant and sort of inconsequential. How do you walk the line between trying to remain relevant, succeeding at what you do without compromising what you know, without basically, can't think of a bad analogy, without compromising your morals in order to continue to succeed in the field that you want to succeed in?
Ooh, okay. It's so interesting because I never went into comedy, and like the morality thing like never came into question. I just was like, oh, I want to get the best that I can at this craft and like try to make a living from it. And like, I'm almost there. And I, you know, I look back, like I'm so grateful for where I am now, because even a few years ago, I'd be like, oh, there's no way I'm going to make a total living from just stand-up comedy. Like, you might as well hang it up and go back to answering phones. But, yeah, it's, I don't know. It's been really great.
Well, what led to you deciding not to perform in any comedy club that was imposing a vaccine requirement for admission?
I felt really called to do it because I think it was August 3rd that de Blasio came out and said that, yeah, New York City was going to start not letting any folks like go to the gym or go to a restaurant unless they showed their papers. And that included comedy clubs and entertainment, right? And like, MSG was already doing it. And I was like, oh, wow, this really sucks. And I remember reading a loophole like, well, performers don't have to be vaccinated. You can just kind of be in and out, just like delivery people, whatever. And I was like, oh, cool, great, a loophole, I can do it. And then I was like, oh, but wait, like that doesn't apply to the audience. And I realized like I would never want to put the audience through that. There's already so much pressure to get this injection. Why would I, you know, add myself to the list of reasons? And I'm not like the biggest comic ever. And of course, when I posted this and was out about it, you know, that you get the comments like, who are you? Never heard of you. And it's like, okay.
Well, and Chrissy, to be fair about this and to be fair in the meanness, what they'll say on the one hand is you're just trying to make yourself relevant by making this an issue. On the other side, if you're too big, I mean, if you're too big, they'll criticize you for being too big to the point where it doesn't affect you. If you're too small, they'll say you're just trying to make yourself relevant. So there really is, the haters are going to hate one way or the other. But the bottom line, I didn't fully appreciate this, and now I'm kind of sick to my stomach hearing it. There's an exception for the performer, but not for the audience in New York.
Ugh, yeah. And I was like, I don't want to. And then I realized, like, my feelings on this are never going to change. Like, I'm never, this is going to be my hill to die on. I am not going to get this thing. Like, I just really believe strongly. And then I got the Rona, and I was like, they shut the country down for this? Like, I was like, okay, well, now I'm a survivor, and I have antibodies. So now I feel even more strongly about it. But I just kind of realized, like, my feelings aren't going to change about this. There need to be more performers and just folks in general speaking out about this. Like, why not take a stand? And there really were no stand-up comics at the time taking a stand. I know then Jim Brewer eventually came out and said he wasn't going to do it. And he's much bigger. So a lot of people are like, oh, wow, he's the first. Not like I'm wanting credit or anything. I was so happy to see him taking that stand. And he's also one of my favorites. I should have mentioned him earlier.
Yeah, but you know what, Chrissy? But even with Jim Brewer, the haters come on and say, oh, he's a has-been. You know, what has he done since?
Of course, SNL? Right?
Effing a-holes on this planet that even when you do the right thing, they try to dump on you. And then,
yeah,
right. I guess
people are not comedy fans who come out and say this. It's just because, like, you're in everybody's pocket, so everybody gets to put their opinion in there. And that's totally okay, because the overwhelming response is like, wow, you're so brave. Keep it up. American flag emoji. And, like, that really... I feel that. It makes me feel so good. I feel like I was kind of the first to do that. And I noticed, you know, there'd be some comics in my DMs like, oh, I'm kind of against this too. But so many comics are so afraid of taking a stand because they don't want to lose friends. They don't want to lose opportunities at clubs. They don't want to lose spots. And then even some days I feel like, oh man, like, oh, it's been a while since I've done a New York City club. But then I'm like, no, it's, I'm absolutely doing the right thing. You know, earning $25 or $50 for a night of doing comedy is not worth, like, getting out my fake papers just to, like, slide through and keep going, you know?
What do you think about Rob Schneider's comment that essentially that Saturday Night Live and other sort of left comedy has become indoctrination? That's not only unfunny, I mean, in the Saturday Night Live, I mean, I can't watch, I mean, Colbert was that, he was funny when he was back on the original show, when he was riffing on Bill O'Reilly, but he was actually still funny. Now he's dancing with vaccine.
And
he got dimwit. I mean, they've all become just political lecturers. And it's really, it was somebody commented about communism way back in the 70s that just said comedy can't coexist in the totalitarian culture. You're not really getting, but any thoughts on what he was saying in terms of what's happening at Saturday Night Live and what's happening in popular comedic culture writ large?
It's absolutely true. And it's absolutely been happening for a while now. My eyes were really open to this a few years ago when Shane Gillis was cast to be like one of the new players on SNL. And one of his haters like went through an old podcast. He said the word jink, big fucking deal, and then sent it to the right person. Then in the span of like a day, lost this job. And it's
for a podcast where he was talking about getting noodles in Chinatown and referring.
Oh, he said neuters, which is hilarious, you know.
It's not, you even defend it. You're insensitive by defending it. It's humor. If you don't find it funny, don't watch it. But you hired a guy presumably because you thought he was funny, and then you pull up this to justify firing him. You end up with crap, and that's why no one cares about SNL anymore.
Hired him precisely to appeal to middle America, to appeal to white guys. Supposedly, people have theories that this was all a setup, that he was trapped to, you know, to make these headlines so that people would watch the show. And I see what happens with people that are scouted or in the running for SNL. There is a period of time where their social media accounts go dark and they sweep up the trash, you know. And there's a website called Social Blade where you can see if people have, this was one of my biggest hobbies, you know, like check out, oh, like whoever is, you know, up and coming, going to be new on SNL. You look and see how many of their tweets are deleted at what date when they appear on SNL. And you're like, okay, that's people going in. That's a cleanup crew happening there, going back real far, like deleting stuff. So you know that that had to have happened with Shane as well. So either this, you know, this was a random podcast from many, many years ago. Maybe they don't scroll through every podcast you've ever done. it's really disgusting. It's been happening for a while. It's just kind of the trend in comedy is this elitist, like faux intellectual, culturally elite, snotty, arrogant. I don't know what it is. Like, I don't, New York City, like the rich people in New York City are very much that way. Like they think they're hot shit because they can go to play every day. It's like, yeah, I was in New York City working every day. Like I had no point occurred to me like, yeah, let me go see a play. Let me go to an art museum. And you're like, this is so boring. Like yeah, I'd rather be like, talking to the guy at the deli.
They're like bad courtiers in the old royal courts. Their intentions and goals are no longer to actually do something that's funny to the ordinary person.
Tim Dillon brought up such a good point. Like he talked about who is hired to do writing on SNL, and it's very homogeneous. Like, sure, like it's probably diverse looking, but they all have the same point of view. They're all kind of within the same age bracket. They would never hire for SNL like a funny UPS delivery guy. They would never hire like a funny garbage man from Staten Island. It's all kind of like, did you go to Harvard? Do you know the right people? Did you go to an Ivy League? Like, you know, maybe are your parents connected? The average Joe does not have a shot at like writing for SNL. And to your point from earlier, Robert, like celebrities are very much like trickle down. Like they're mini politicians at this point. And most people don't want to get into caring about politics because that's a lot of work. That's a lot of reading. That's a lot of history you have to be aware of. Like you kind of have to care. You can't be a little bit into caring about politics, but there's no such commitment for following celebrities. It's just, it's like brainless. It's like, oh, I like Cardi B. Oh, she likes Biden. I guess I'll vote for him. Whew. That's it for me. I don't have to think for another 4 years. So that that's kind of a lot of what the comedians, like the Hollywood comedians have kind of become, like the Sarah Silvermans. And of course now all the late night hosts, save for Greg Gutfeld, who's crushing it. But yeah, it's very much projection and ideology and telling people what to think rather than like just being funny and seeing who laughs at it.
I'm going to read this one. Are you telling me Jaden, I guess that means Miss Jaden Smith, although in French, M-E is maître, which is a lawyer, isn't talented? Well, I never. Now, just to plug, Eric Hunley and Mark Grobert have a new show on YouTube and it's great, but they talked about the fact that Will Smith might have been a CIA implant mole in Hollywood to, you know, to give the FBI, CIA intelligence a good look in movies. Interesting side note. But Chrissy, speaking of, you know, you make the decision not to play clubs that require vaccination, which I guess goes state by state now. Other than losing the gigs, and it's true, you know, you say it's not a big monetary loss, but you're dealing now with reputational loss in that the media is going to put you in the same basket of deplorables as Brewer, as Eric Clapton, as Jam for Freedom, as any entity that opposes these measures. And they're not going to call you someone standing up for freedom of choice. They're going to call you an anti-vaxxer. I mean, what impact practically does that actually have on the life of a working comedian? And has it been good? Has it been net positive or net negative for your online YouTube and other platforms?
Everyone is different, right? Like you look at Eric Clapton, you're like, well, he's untouchable. He's got enough money to live. Like, you know, nobody, you can't torpedo his career. Like he's a legend, but sure enough, even recently an article came out like framing him as some kind of racist.
From the 70s.
Oh, it's insane. It's insane. They're really trying hard. And then like Brewer, kind of a legend in his own way, you know, just, if you're into comedy, you're going to find him funny. And right. Anybody else be like, who is he? He's washed up. I think if I were bigger, I would probably be getting more flack. I think I've been already kind of swept into like the, who knows, the right or whatever, like the new right. I don't know. It's hard to know. Like what group am I even in? But I feel like it's been a net positive, just being true to myself and my feelings. It's like, you feel good about it. It just like, it makes me feel, it feels like a risk, but I feel stronger for doing it. And especially when I see so many positive comments, because I know there's so many people who can't or are not brave enough to come out about it. And it's like, I just feel like I'm pretty lucky. Like I don't have any kids that I have to, you know, maybe make certain sacrifices to keep them alive. You know, like I can do this. I can be out there. like, I'm not afraid of getting fired from like some corporate job or whatever. Like, my boss is a radio legend. And then I have like other streams of income, and I've been figuring out YouTube. So I've been lucky with that, but I really feel like this is like a calling for me. And, I feel like it's important to bring people together on this and give them the confidence to speak out.
And are you still doing shows, and what's the upcoming schedule look like?
Yes. I'm going to actually be in Jersey this Saturday with the Comedians of the Compound. We'll be in Lakewood, New Jersey, doing the Blue Claws Stadium. And then I'm headlining November 6th at the Dojo of Comedy in Morris Plains, New Jersey. And then working on a few more dates, but I'll be in Albany. I'll be out on Long Island. Might be planning something for Savannah, Georgia. I'll be in Nashville actually next weekend for a convention, not for comedy, but like more like interview podcast stuff. So,
Chrissy, so I mean, do I understand that in New Jersey there's no vaccine passports, but in New York City there is?
Correct. And as of right now, there isn't any in like Westchester or Long Island. It's really just like New York City. I've heard there is a comedy venue in Brooklyn that may not be mandating this, so I'll have to try to check that out. But right, that's why, you know, Jack Murphy was, you know, he was going to have his like jacked brunch, and he had that in Jersey City, because he was supposed to do it in New York City. But then, of course, like, I meet people who are like, oh, I went to this restaurant or that restaurant, and they didn't check for my papers. It's like, well, I'm not going to like take that risk. Like, I just go to my one bar across the street from the studio, and I'm good. And it's like, ultimately, I'm saving money, you know, going out.
Chrissy, I'm banking on the fact that one day our unpopular position today will actually be the one that people are thankful for and grateful for in the future. I don't have to work in this industry that you work in, where, you know, you get blacklisted, and you'll get blacklisted, and people won't invite you to the clubs. And even if you want to, you know, sign up for a gig, yeah, they're busy, or they'll call you back. And I don't know how it works in stand-up, but I mean, hopefully people see the value that stand-up has to be funny in order to draw crowds. And what was, there was a tweet the other day about four people talking about making communism funny. I'm missing the tweet, if anybody remembers it, and it just got lambasted. Like, they said, you know, Can socialism be funny, or socialist humor? It was terrible.
Oh God, I remember that. It was this article. It was like this comedy team.
Yes, it was a troop of four, and I was like, oh, if anybody in the chat remembers, if anyone can find the link. But humor has to be funny, and it has to be edgy in order to be funny, and it has to be insightful and truthful in order to be funny. So you mix all that together, you haven't lost your desire to continue plugging away in the field.
Yeah, of course. Like, that's total virtue signaling, that whole article about, like, can socialism be funny? Like, that's some, like, bored blogger that's got to fulfill her article minimum or whatever. Or that's somebody's agent that's like, let me put out this piece and make it look like news. It's gross. Yeah.
Any thoughts on Dave Chappelle? I mean, I thought his he comes from the left and all of that, and people can have, you know, whatever they think of his comedy. Some people are fans, some people are not. But I thought it was a very personal presentation. It was really brilliantly narrated, just from a literary kind of structuring perspective. He bookmarked it beginning and end, had a lot of dramatic stuff in there, much more so than I anticipated. But what were your thoughts about it, and how do you think the comedy world will react to it?
I loved it. I laughed when people were like, let's cancel him. I'm like, girl, he's been paid for this special a long time ago. Like, this was the sixth special of his sixth special deal with them. Like, that money's been in his bank for a minute. And again, it's just like, oh, this is the thing we're talking about to virtue signal. Like, you're not going to touch him, even though he's, you know, and he even jokes about it. He's like, people drag me on Twitter, but luckily Twitter isn't a real place. Within the first 5 minutes, he made fun of, you know, coronavirus. He's like, oh, people had to die for this special to be made. He also in the first 5 minutes joked about like getting molested by a preacher. So it's like, he really hit up all the groups. He compared like black people beating up Asians for like Stop Asian Hate. He's like, that's what was going on inside my body. Like, I had COVID.
Spoil too much.
Oh, whoops. Okay. I won't spoil. You'll still laugh when you hear it.
If anyone read a review of it, you'll get the best punchlines. But
yeah,
do we spoil it, Robert? Because I mean, the last anecdote about how the LGBTQ community turning on their own, leading to, you know, disastrous consequences, should be a wake up call for everybody. But maybe we don't want to spoil the punchline. But it was, Chrissy, what I thought watching the comedy, watching his special, I watched it last night with my wife. It was like the first adult thing that we've watched since I watched Joker alone. I think I could find what the stories that were actually true and the stories that did not actually happen to Chappelle. The priest one, you know, could be called generic comedy in a sense. But the more personal ones that you know actually happened to him, like the story with the transgender person who...
Ruin it. They've had their chance.
Okay, so the whole punchline of his anecdote at the end about talking about how a transgender person defended him for the attacks from the transgender community on him for his last special. She got, dragged. I didn't know there was a word on Twitter. And then ended up, you know, taking their own life. And he said, you did this through the intolerance and I'm not going to stop now. And this is, you know, this is sort of my personal, not vendetta, but this is my personal anecdote that the tolerance is the intolerance at this point in time. And it was a very impactful thing, but is he going to get canceled? Can he get canceled? I mean, he's still the funniest and the most insightful comedian out there.
Yeah, absolutely not. He's definitely not going to get canceled. And it's so funny to now see, like, supposedly the transgender Netflix employees are going to stage like a walkout like next Wednesday. They're just going to call out sick for like one day, like big deal. He says the things that we are all thinking, like as a comic, I'm so inspired, just listening to it. Like it gets the gears turning. And it makes me think like, oh, wow, you can just talk about like what you feel about how things are. And he just makes it look so easy. He also harkens back to like old school, like Chappelle, every time he says the N-word or goes to that like higher octave, like I can't even do it. But it's like his like dramatic higher octave. And it's just funny to be like, look, Dave Chappelle is not transphobic. It's just that trans people are so easy to make fun of. That is not his fault. And I like that he talks about like his opener and he really puts he's so eloquent in his ability to be like, yeah, like the LGBT community, they are now like the top bullies, like they are now kind of punching down on all of us. And he said, like, you know, stop punching down on my community. He basically says like comics.
Well, you know, his bit, I mean, it's the funny thing is, who is he making fun of? In the joke where he says, you know, how the black community is angry at the gay and trans community because of the strides they've made in such a short period of time, whereas, you know, 200 years and the black community is still struggling for anything close to what the trans and gay community has gotten in the last 50 years. I mean, who does that joke poke fun at so that anybody gets offended? Or does it just poke fun at everybody while being observationally true? I mean, that's the beauty of actual meaningful comedy, is that there has to be an element of truth in it. Like, you know, we started off the stream with, otherwise it's just not funny. There's nothing insightful about it. And therefore it's irrelevant. That was my closing rant.
Exactly. But, like, what are you going to do? Like, is it really Chappelle's fault? Because that whole room full of people was laughing. Like, do you want to go through and find each of these people and cancel each one of these people? Because like, without people laughing, like he doesn't exist. He doesn't have a career. So it's like, are we going to cancel the people who enjoyed this?
Chrissy, well, yeah, I had that thought watching. I was like, holy cow, some of those people are identifiable in the front row and they might get in trouble for laughing too hard.
Well, I watched the Second City show in Chicago when I was for whatever reason, the corporate law firm decided that would be a good excursion that I was clerking at for second year summer. And this was after, the guy who played Superman had fallen off the horse and become, you know, had an accident. Well, so they are playing the Superman music and he came out in a wheelchair and I just fell over the chair laughing. Nobody else was laughing. Everybody else was trying to hold their laughing back. It didn't go over well with the corporate law firm, but I didn't care. But I was like, that's the way humor used to be. Things that you're thinking, but you're not supposed to say, but down deep, you just want to let it out into the world. And Chappelle just was, you know, blunt and he had a purpose. He had a purpose of, these are privileged communities pretending to be abused, disadvantaged communities who are taking a lot of time beating up on some of the most vulnerable communities. And that at core, cancel culture is punching down, never punching up.
Absolutely. It's like you're not acknowledging the power you have all the while you're acting like you're a victim and you need more attention and more things. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty gross.
Now, Chrissy, we're going to keep this to under 2 hours for a couple of reasons, one of which is transposing this to podcast. But Chrissy, where can everyone watching, if they don't already know to find you, where can they find you?
Yeah, Instagram, Chrissy Mayer Pod, C-H-R-I-S-S-I-E-M-A-Y-R. On Twitter, I'm just Chrissy Mayer. on Compound Media Mondays at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. And then, yeah, like, check out my YouTube channel. I also do like uncensored content for Rockfin, where we talk about all the no-no subjects you can't talk about on YouTube. And yeah, just follow me on all the things. I am not on TikTok.
And are you on Locals yet?
I'm not, but it's like, I need to. It's okay, long overdue.
I think I sent you I sent you a contact. Regardless, I will remind you, get on Locals. I need it's to get a good on place. It.
Because that's where I will be afterwards at our, we have a live chat going at vivabarneslaw.locals.com, because the benefit of it is censor-free conversation and communication and a good backup in case at some point the big tech overlords decide exclude your voice, as they are too many others.
Yeah, people need comedy. It's like there's propaganda is at an all-time high. Our media is lying to us, and comics are among the only people who are actually just allowed to be honest right now. It sucks.
They're the modern day philosophers, and when they do it well, they get attacked quickly, because that's how you know you're being effective. Everyone in the chat, thank you very much for tuning in. Thanks for the support. Thank you for all the comments, super chats, etc. Chrissy, Robert, stick around. We'll say our proper goodbyes. Everyone else, this will be on podcast tomorrow on Locals Direct, and Sunday night streams are coming. So with that said, everyone, enjoy what is left of the week.